Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, proud supporter of live music and driven to think big about beer since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Think big about beer.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking about the art of songwriting. How's a hit made?
We'll look at two different eras, very different eras in pop music. We'll talk with Ryan Tedder of the pop rock band One Republic about writing for the likes of Beyonce and Taylor Swift. But first, we'll talk with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, the couple behind immortal hits like You've Lost That Love and Feeling, On Broadway, We've Got to Get Out of This Place, and many, many others.
That's right, Jim. Their careers began in the early 1960s in the Brill Building. That was that big hit factory right in the middle of Midtown Manhattan. There, Mann and Weil worked alongside friends Jerry Goffin and Carole King and other great songwriters, crafting hits for people like Phil Spector, who was the great producer from that early 60s rock and roll era. They're one of the few songwriting teams, Mann and Weil, to survive well beyond the 60s, both in their careers and in their love life. They've been happily married to one another since 1961.
We talked with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil back in 2011, and we started the conversation by asking the duo how they became songwriting partners and eventually life partners.
I was writing with a singer-songwriter named Teddy Randazzo, and Barry came up to play Teddy a song, and I saw him and I was smitten, and I found out where he was signed as a writer, and I arranged to have an appointment with Don Kirshner at Alden Music so that I could see Barry again.
So Alden Music is like right next door to the Brill Building. It's at 1650 Broadway. The Brill Building's like across the street, right?
Well, yeah, it's like a block away.
Okay.
1650 had, at that time, the Young Turks, the publishing companies that had younger writers signed.
Well, so you were writing with somebody else, Cynthia, and you saw this guy, you were smitten.
Yes.
And you wanted to write with him?
Yes. Well, I wanted to date him. I didn't care about writing with him.
That was a polite way of saying she wanted to date me.
Yes.
Right. Wow. You know what blows my mind about this era? You are extremely young when you're working there. I mean, you are writing hit songs, and you're like late teens, early 20s, right?
Well, my first hit, I was 19 years old. It was a song called She Say Doobie Doom by the Diamonds.
Yes, sounds like it was written by a four-year-old.
And later on, I did Who Put the Bump.
So, right.
And then I learned how to speak English.
And then you wrote with me.
Right. Who put the bump in the bump, bump, bump? Who put the rhyme in the ram-a-lam-a ding dong? Who put the bop in the bop, shoo-bop, shoo-bop? Who put the dip in the dip, 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 dip? Who was that man? I'd like to shake his hand. He made my baby fall in love with me.
The relationship developed sort of outside of the writing, or would you say that the writing brought the two of you closer together where you ended up being married?
Barry, do you want to take that, or should I?
Yeah, I really think that the writing did bring us closer together. We were attracted to each other, but the writing kind of clinched the deal. I asked to see her lyrics, and I really loved what she had written. She had a style that was very sophisticated, but at the same time, it was very soulful. But she really wasn't familiar with the pop market, and I told her to listen to the Drifter records, and I told her to listen to the Everly Brothers and a lot of R&B records, too. And she picked it up very quickly, and she was able to combine that sophistication with soul.
I was writing for another company at the time called Lesser Music, which was owned by Frank Lesser, who wrote How to Succeed in Business and Most Happy Fella, and the writers up there were mostly show writers, and because that's the direction I thought my career would be going.
Yeah, the Broadway thing was very important to you. I know you had some theatrical background. You did some dancing, right, Cynthia? So
right.
How did you end up, quote-unquote, slumming in the pop world?
Well, you know, it's amazing what love and lust will do to your career direction. But uh-huh. Barry was in rock and roll, and he taught me rock and roll. And we started writing, and I got a little diverted from the theatrical path.
For about 40 years.
Yeah.
He put the bump in your bump shabomp, right?
He absolutely did. You know, that's a very good way of putting it.
As I've read the story, when you first approached Kirshner, thinking you wanted to get your eyes on this cute-looking guy, Barry, again, they were interested in hiring you, and they wanted to put you with this other songwriter. What's her name? Oh, yeah, Carole King.
Right.
You could have had a completely different career in life.
Well, I don't think it really would have happened because Carol was writing with her husband, Jerry Goffin, and Jerry at the time was a chemist during the day. He was a chemist by day, songwriter by night. Kirshner said, she's not writing with anyone during the day. She should be writing with somebody. So why don't you write with her? So I went out to Carol's apartment in Brooklyn, and she gave me a melody that I really liked. Even I, who did not know pop music, thought this was very hit-sounding. And by the time I got home, my phone was ringing, and it was Carol saying, you know, I know this isn't the right way to start a writing relationship, but Jerry came home from work, and he heard the melody I gave you, and he was very interested in it himself, and I have to ask you for it back.
Wow.
She said, he even has a title. So I said, well, what's the title, you know? And she said, Take Good Care of My Baby. I said, that's a good title, Carol. You know, yeah. I'm giving it back to you.
Take good care of my baby. Please don't ever make her blue. Just tell her that you love her. Make sure you're thinking of her in everything you say and do.
You were successful at a really young age. What's fascinating to me is that there was these stables of songwriters. You know, the Brill Building, you and Alden Publishing. I mean, we're talking about some heavy hitters, Neil Sedaka, Howard Greenfield, you know, King Goffin, yourselves. Barry, describe what a working day was like here with these songwriters around. I mean, were you guys literally like working right next to each other, competing for songs?
Yeah, sometimes. Alden Music had offices where there was a big main room, and on the circumference of the room were these little cubicles. There must have been about five or six. And the cubicles just had like an upright piano, a piano bench, a chair, and an ashtray. Some people would be lucky and they'd have a window, you know. So a lot of times we would be writing, and Kirshner would say, the Drifters are up. So everybody would run to their cubicles and they'd start writing for the Drifters. So you'd hear everybody's melodies through the wall and that kind of stuff.
Well, Saturday night at 8 o'clock, I know where I'm gonna go. I'm gonna pick my baby up and take her to the picture show. Everybody in the neighborhood is dressing up to be there too. And we're gonna have a ball just like we always do. Saturday night at the movies, who cares what picture you see? When you're hugging with your baby, last row in the balcony.
But it was a very competitive atmosphere, very competitive, especially between Carol and Jerry and Cynthia and myself. They were the talents, and they felt that way about us. And so it was.
Well, everyone was talented, but they were the other married couple talent, and they were also our closest friends up there.
Yeah, it was very confusing because being that they were our friends, we really had great times with them. We really loved them. But at the same time, we wanted that next record, and they wanted that next record.
Right. And so it was bad news when we heard they got it, but we'd have to smile and say, great.
You know? Yeah. So a well-natured but nonetheless intense competition like the Beatles and the Stones a couple of years later.
Absolutely, right. Yeah.
Now you got a man who's gonna get you smiling every day. Baby, happy times are here to stay.
Cynthia, Barry, we have to talk about You've Lost That Love and Feeling. Recorded by the Righteous Brothers in 1964, it's been honored by BMI as the most performed song of the 20th century, which is really saying something. Take us through that song.
Well, let me start, and Barry, you take over, okay?
Sure.
We had met Phil Spector, and he asked us to come out to California to write with him. So Phil played us a record by these two guys from Orange County, And they were both up-tempo songs that Bill Medley had written. One was called Little Latin Loopy Lou, and the other was called My Babe. And he said, I've just signed these guys, and believe it or not, they're white guys from Orange County, although they sound like Sam and Dave. And we would want to write something, have you guys write something for them.
And we started, we wrote two verses and a chorus, and we didn't know how to end the chorus. So we called up Phil. We wanted to get his input. And we used the title, You've Lost That Lovely Feeling, as a dummy title. We didn't really like the title. So when we played it for Phil, and when we were done playing, we said to Phil, now, Phil, man, you know, don't worry about the title. We'll get a better title. He says, no, you won't, man. That's the title.
Hmm.
We ended up finishing the song. We went over to Phil's place, and we finished the rest of the song. And then the next day, we went up and we played it for Bill and Bobby. So Phil and I sang the song to him. And after we were done, it was dead silence. Then Bill said, well...
No, it was Bobby.
Bill said, sounds good for the Everly Brothers. You know?
Oh, right.
And then Bobby said, well, what am I... You know, because the way the song was set up, it was Bill was singing the verses, and then Bobby would just do harmony on the choruses, and then they'd trade off on the bridge. So when they were done, Bobby says, well, what am I supposed to do? Why, the big guy's singing. And Phil didn't miss a beat. He says, you go to the bank.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. There's no tenderness like before in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it, but baby.
What's amazing to me is that you were kind of on this made-to-order business, constant deadlines. You had to write on a deadline all the time. And yet you were able to come up with these very, some people could describe that as kind of generic, so universal to the point where I could lose any kind of, you know, personal feeling. And yet you were able to drop these lines in there. Like, I understand that Spector was blown away by the first line of You've Lost That Love and Feeling. Right away, he seemed to sense that you had something there that was above and beyond.
The verses and choruses, I think the line that knocked him out.
Something beautiful's dying. When I sang that line, he said, you know, I feel like crying. I mean, it was a very moving line.
It makes me just feel like crying.
We never imagined that it would be the most performed song of the 20th century. It was just something that we liked, and Phil made a magnificent record.
Yeah, and Phil said, you know, this is going to be a very important song for all of us. And Cynthia, being a show baby, you know, a theater kid, said any song that has whoa, whoa, whoa in it could never be important.
Which shows you how much I know.
How were you able to sort of get that sort of specificity and sort of that personal connection, you know, when you kiss me, you know, you never close your eyes anymore, those kind of things. I mean, it seemed like you were drawing on personal stuff and investing in these universal songs. And I think that's one of the keys to why that song is so well loved over the years.
Well, I have two thoughts about that. I think that really great writers are not just perceptive. I almost feel they're psychic in a way, and they have the capacity to almost become the artist they're writing for. And I think that really is a tremendous advantage. So that's one of the reasons. And I'm forgetting the second reason.
But there's a time in your life, when, in a creative person's life, when they're very much in tune with the cultural zeitgeist or the universal thought and can tune into it. And I just kind of felt at that point that anything that I like or anything that I write about is something that other people feel. So some of it was based on personal experience, some of it was based on friends' experience, and some of it was just based on that part of your brain that clicks on when someone says, be creative.
Yeah, I think that even if you're writing for an artist, and you may not have lived that artist's life, but I still think some of your personal experience will go into that lyric or that melody.
No doubt about it. Cynthia, I know that some of the sophistication you are bringing to these pop songs to this day, I think, is striking. I'm thinking of something like Uptown by the Crystals, mm-hmm. which I know has been described as almost like one of the first songs that was, you know, sociological, you know, and here we were
right.
in the pop heyday. Again, drawing on these very specific kind of vignettes. I mean, were these things that you would observe and then sort of write down? I mean, how would these sort of observations come to you that you would end up incorporating them in lyrics to hit songs?
That was something that I observed. But first, I want to say that I went to a very progressive high school, and everybody was into Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and Hootenannies and that kind of thing. And I saw music as a form of social protest and a form of expressing political views. And so I think I brought a little of that to pop music when I got into pop. With Uptown, I had observed very tall, handsome African-American guy pushing something that, you know, those things that have all the clothes on them in the garment district. And he looked like an African king. And I thought, here he is pushing a clothes rack. What is his life like? And then I wrote that song.
But then he comes uptown each evening to my tenement. Uptown where folks don't have to pay much rent. And when he's there with me, he can see that he's everything. Then he's tall.
After a short break, we're going to return to our conversation with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, where they talk about more of their timeless tunes. Later, a conversation with Ryan Tedder. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.